We're going to officially call to order the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Today is Wednesday, April 10th. We do have a quorum, so if someone would move the minutes. Representative Johnson moves the minutes of April 9th. Any corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, the first item that we're going to talk about on the agenda is House File 1752. Members, we are not going to vote on this bill, but we need to hear it. Members, this bill was included in Representative Paymar's omnibus bill, and so we need to make sure that we talk about the issue because this is within the jurisdiction of this committee, but we don't need to pass it as it is moving along on its own. Members, because we just got the bill sent to us today on the floor, there also is an amendment that technically didn't meet the 24-hour rule, but I was hoping that Representative Simonson could talk about the bill and talk about the amendment because we want to make sure that we get the policy right. It isn't going to be moving from this committee. Representative Paymar will be deciding if he's going to make that change in his bill or not. But I thought we as a committee should talk about it. So any concerns or questions from the members? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair, we've got amendments for this bill. Is that right?
Representative Druskowski, there is one A1 amendment that I'd like to talk about, but we will not be voting on or passing this bill out. It will be staying within the jurisdiction of this committee. We just need to hear the issue.
Thank
Representative
you,
Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, Representative Simonson, the chair would move House File 1752. Representative Simonson, is the A1 amendment an amendment that you'd like me to bring before this committee?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, the chair then would move the A1 amendment for Representative Simonson to talk about as part of his bill. So, Representative Simonson, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll keep my comments very brief here, and then we'll turn it over to a testifier. But essentially, this bill fixes what is commonly referred to as 36-month presumptive sentencing, a provision of law that was inadvertently repealed as part of sentencing reform back in 2006. Essentially requires presumptive or mandatory sentence for repeat conviction of a serious criminal sexual assault. Would apply to serious criminal sexual offenses, second, third, fourth degree criminal, and would apply to repeat offenses that occur within 15 months of the previous offense. The policy of requiring incarceration for those who repeat a serious criminal sexual offense was a longstanding policy, and as the testifiers I'm sure will explain today, the policy was repealed through error and not through policy deliberations. This bill is being introduced with the support of Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, as well as support by the Minnesota Association of County Attorneys. And with that, Madam Chair, I turn it over to the testifier.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I am the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I am here to speak in favor and support of House File 1010 and House File 1752 now with its amendment before the committee today. The bill is supported by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association as well, and we'd like to thank Representative Simonson for serving as chief author on this bill. Just very briefly, this is not a new policy initiative. MnCASA first became aware of the need for this legislation during the 2007 session. We learned that the presumptive executed sentencing for repeat offenders had been inadvertently omitted during updates to the sentencing guidelines. What was intended as an effort to strengthen penalties for sex offenders had an unintended effect of weakening penalties for some repeat offenses. In the years since, we have worked in a bipartisan manner at the legislature to correct this omission. And although the bill has always passed through committees without controversy, it's just been held back by a small fiscal note over the years. The bill does still have a fiscal note, but it is still small. It's zero in the first 2 years and minimal in the next 2 years. We do think this is a small amount to pay to ensure that repeat offenders are held accountable in the legal and correctional systems. The amendment clarifies the stay process so that it's in accord with the current criminal sexual conduct statutes. I am joined today by Ann Wall from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission and Assistant Goodhue County Attorney Aaron Kuster, and they can answer any technical questions or provide any additional information to the committee.
Thank you. Questions from members? So, members, let me just clarify how the A1 amendment came about. Members, I just had some questions about the lines on the original bill about the stays of execution that were in the bill. Line 1.17 is where it started. And members, after consulting with the folks who've been working on this for a long time, The language that's in the A1 amendment is actually mirrors what's in the other statutes already in the criminal sexual conduct statutes. And so rather than having new language, I thought it would be appropriate to go with language that's already in statutes in the other sections. So if there isn't any objection, I would like us to adopt the A1 amendment, knowing that the bill's not going anywhere and that Representative Paymar will have the ability in Ways and Means if he chooses to make this change in his bill in Ways and Means, but the bill will not be leaving the committee. Any questions or concerns from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess, Madam Chair, I'm concerned about process. We didn't receive the amendment with the 24-hour deadline that is within the committee's rules. And, you know, I think we need to be able to have the deliberation and a chance for all members to take a good look at this. So I would concur with your earlier notion to not take a vote on the amendment and to give us a chance to chew on this and maybe come back at a different day in order to provide the process necessary.
Representative Drazkowski, just for clarification, we don't have to bring this up again. We just need to vet this issue because Representative Paymar will ultimately get to make the decision on his bill in Ways and Means whether or not he makes this change. So I just want to make sure that we talk about whatever concerns we might have on the issue. That's all. Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, Representative Drazkowski, if I might, if you would be willing to at least take a look at this new language, and if you have concerns, make certain that the author knows so that as this bill moves forward, as part of Representative Paymar's omnibus bill, we make certain that we get the language correct. All right. With that, the chair lays over House File 1752. Thank you, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1139. Members, this is a bill that we are not going to vote on today. We are going to be laying this bill over, but this is a very important issue that we need to talk about as well. Representative Liebling submitted the A4 amendment, and it made it to the committee today. Last night, I think we got it at 6:43, technically outside the 24-hour rule, but because we're not going to be voting on the bill today, I think we should let Representative Liebling talk about the A4 amendment. So welcome to the committee, Representative Liebling. Please, why don't you go ahead and describe for us the contents of your bill as it would be amended by the A4 amendment.
All right. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for taking the time to consider this really important issue. And, members, I just want to start by drawing your attention to, I don't know how many of you get this little, we all get this Capitol Report newspaper in our boxes all the time, and there's just recently a very good article about this whole issue by Paul Demko, and I just want to refer you to that because this is an issue that the public is paying attention to. It's also an issue that has been worked on bipartisanly over some years, and Representative Cornish did a lot of work on this in the last couple of years, and it's a really tough issue for us to crack. And a lot of the reason for that is because the very difficult politics around this issue. There is very little that's more important to our state than public safety, and you all on this committee have a very weighty responsibility to do what you can to make sure that the public is safe. At the same time, we as a state are facing really a crossroads on the issue of what we do with our civilly committed sex offenders, because we have a program that has been growing and growing and growing, and there is now a class action lawsuit where a federal judge is looking very closely at this issue. And we don't know where that judge is going to go. But the judge has appointed a task force, of which I'm a member, to look at this issue as a first step, because the signal is coming pretty loud and clear that if we don't do something about this ourselves as a legislature, that the federal court may do it for us. And we may not like what the court decides to do. I think most of us feel pretty protective of our positions here as representatives of our districts and of the state, and we want to make the decisions. And in other areas, you know, I do a lot of work in health and human services. There's a lot of controversy about what the feds do to us versus what kinds of decisions we make. this is one where we really need to make the decision. But it's a tough area, and it's very tough at election time, especially when it becomes a partisan issue and it gets used against people in elections. And we need to really try as much as we can here in the legislature to call a truce on that one. Not that we shouldn't debate the issues and what we're actually changing in particular, but if we can't touch this issue because it's too much of a third rail, then we're really consigning ourselves to letting the federal government or the federal court in particular make the decision for us. And I hope that that's not what we're going to do. And so I've been working very closely with a number of parties on this, and I have here with me today two very distinguished, the chair and co-chair of the task force that the federal court established, and I'm going to let them give you a bit more background about the lawsuit, and we can go through the amendment that we've put forward, which is a product of a lot of work from a lot of parties, and I very much welcome your input on the particulars. But I just want to ask you to please, let's put the partisan politics aside, or just even the sex offender politics, if you will, because sometimes this is bipartisanly, you know, this is not one of those issues where one side or the other has been, so to speak, to blame. There have been heroes and devils, I suppose, if you want to use that word, bad word, I can't think of the right word, but there have been people on both sides of this who've done well with the issue and done poorly, who've been in both parties. So this is not something that, this must be a bipartisan issue where we all kind of hold hands and take a deep breath and say, how can we do better for our state? How can we spend our money better to get better public safety? And how can we make sure that we are within the law so a federal court is not going to turn over everything that we do here? So with that background, I'm going to turn it over to former Chief Justice Magnuson and let him make a few words and we'll go from there.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric Magnuson. I'm here with Judge James Rosenbaum. As Representative Liebling has told you, we are in charge of a task force that has been appointed pursuant to a federal court order to examine and make recommendations concerning Minnesota's sex offender civil commitment program. Minnesota is one of 20 states that civilly commits sex offenders after they have completed the sentence for their criminal conviction. Minnesota is has the highest per capita commitment rate of any of those 20 states. For the past 30 years, Minnesota has committed civilly sex offenders after they've served their sentences, and with only a couple of exceptions, no one has gotten out of the civil commitment program. I have talked to some of you about this before. To me, it's kind of like Devil's Lake, North Dakota. The rivers flow in, but there's no outlet, and the lake keeps growing. It's estimated that if nothing is done by the end of 2020, there will be over 1,100 people in Minnesota civilly committed. This raises significant constitutional issues. In theory, there is a constitutional basis for committing someone to medical care if they present a danger to themselves or others. It's quite common we do that. You've heard of 72-hour holds and things like that. But what you can't do is lock someone up because you're afraid they're going to commit a crime in the future. You can only punish people for crimes they have committed. So if you're going to civilly commit someone because they suffer from an illness or a disease, you have to provide treatment. Treatment that results in no one being released or one person being released in 30 years simply is not effective and is highly questionable. There is a lawsuit pending in the federal court for the state of Minnesota, District of Minnesota, where the way in which the sex offender program is operated is being challenged as violating the constitutional rights of those who are committed. It's a serious lawsuit. It started off with the inmates or the offenders representing themselves. The court has appointed extremely competent and extremely dedicated lawyers who are working on their behalf. This is not the first time that federal courts have been asked to address civil commitment issues. In the state of Washington, a number of years ago, A similar challenge was brought in federal court, and it resulted in the federal court invalidating the civil commitment process in Washington and basically imposing sanctions on the state and requiring them to make significant changes no matter what the cost was. Now, this is an issue that has a lot of history. We have provided to some of you in the past a packet of information that we've collated at the task force that answers a lot of questions that are commonly brought up. We have an excellent website, and we will see that staff get the most current version of this compilation. But it basically starts at the beginning. It summarizes what the law is in Minnesota. It looks at the studies that have been done by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, the Governor's Task Force appointed by Governor Pawlenty in 2005 to study the system, and the internal review and report of the Department of Human Services. Those reports, despite their diverse origins, are remarkably consistent in recognizing the problems that exist currently with the sex offender program. Those problems are what prompted the lawsuit. And what Judge Donovan Frank, who is the presiding judge in the case, has done is he has told the state of Minnesota, basically, appoint an independent task force, get some advice on how you can solve these problems so that I don't have to. I mean, that's the best way I can read it. So our task force, which consists of more than 20 members, prosecutors, defense lawyers, judges, mental health professionals, law enforcement representatives, began meeting in October. The federal court gave us three tasks: to basically look at the way people get into the system, to look at what happens to people as they try to move through the system, and to figure out if there are changes in the way people move out of the civil commitment system. But the court told us that our first priority should be that middle part. How can people receive effective and appropriate treatment when they're committed, and how can they move towards completing that treatment successfully and returning to society? We submitted those recommendations in December. Basically, they said that the state needs to have less restrictive alternatives, that you can't effectively treat many of these people when they're locked up behind razor wire at Moose Lake or St. Peter. It is simply the start of a long process. I don't think anybody expects that the system will be reformed overnight, and as I understand the legislative proposals that are before you, that's not the goal right now. It is to move forward in small steps and deal with those things that can be done now and continue to examine the other issues. I want to emphasize a couple of things. First of all, we don't have, our task force doesn't have a stake in the outcome here. We are simply advising the legislature and the Department of Human Services, as we were charged to do, with solutions to the problems that the state itself has already recognized. The Office of the Legislative Auditor has a very comprehensive report that points out the problems with the current system. We tried to have bipartisan support, which I think we've achieved, for some reasonable solutions to move away from those problems on a constitutional level. The second thing is that if the state doesn't act, Judge Rosenbaum and I are fairly confident that the federal court will. And I simply want to repeat that that, to me, would be really the worst solution for the state of Minnesota. A federal court wields a broadsword. It does not use a scalpel. It doesn't make fine policy distinctions. It doesn't balance interests. It simply says, that's broken, fix it. If you don't fix it, I'm going to sanction you. And the sanctions could be so much as going to release sex offenders. In California, when the state did not correct constitutional deficiencies in their prison system, the federal court gave them some time, smacked them around some, gave them some sanctions, and when they didn't fix it, started releasing prisoners. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen here, but if you want to control the result, the state needs to take some action. We think we've made very reasonable recommendations. We don't believe that they should be highly controversial. This is a very difficult issue, and so to a certain extent, anything that touches on it evokes strong feelings, but these are good solutions. Judge Rosenbaum.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. My name is James Rosenbaum. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, members, for the opportunity to be present. I sat on the United States District Court for 25 years, and the federal court in Minnesota is quite unlike most of them because in most cases you only do financial cases, banking cases, securities, constitutional. But Minnesota is one of the very few which have a number of Indian reservations. I sat on cases involving child abuse. I know what these cases are like. I have dealt with the victims, dealt with the perpetrators. This is not a pair of Pollyannas sitting here talking to you. This is a very complicated, as you know, in some ways you know better than we, how complicated and difficult this problem is. What started out, I believe, as a well-intentioned plan of some sort of a treatment or therapeutic environment after somebody's done with being incarcerated, but the problem is it didn't develop as it ought. When 600 people, now more than 620, have been admitted into a program that supposedly is a progression, and one in 20-some years has gotten out, this is not a progressive therapeutic environment, and no court will find it to be. It is the nature of the judge's work that I would not ask my former colleague how he's going to do or what he's going to do about the case. I have not spoken with him about it. That's not ever going to happen. But I will tell you, having sat in that position, out of respect for the state, the federal judge is not interested in bringing undue pressure into a state. The state has a problem. You know it very well. Justice Magnuson has pointed out that there are at least three good studies that have been done within the state of Minnesota by state officials, and they all say the same thing. This is a broken system. It's a broken system that needs to be fixed. Only 20 of the 50 states have anything like this system. We have, as I think Eric pointed out, the highest per capita detention rate in this kind of a facility of any state in the United States. And you know and I know that Minnesota's offenders are no worse than anybody else's, but we've got what I have referred to as a Venus flytrap. He talks about flooding the South Dakota. That may be South Dakota's problem, but a Venus flytrap I'm familiar with. You get into it and you don't get out. And that's the system we have. It is not sustainable financially. It is not sustainable legally. It is not sustainable constitutionally. The United States Constitution, indeed Minnesota's Constitution, will not allow you to detain somebody because you think they're not nice people. Even when what they've done is horrifying, either they are to be incarcerated or at a certain point they need an opportunity to be reintegrated into society. This case presents a perfect example of a situation where you, as the representatives of Minnesota, are in a better position, believe me, the judge knows, than he, to fix this problem. The suggestions that we are making, not one is any different, really. Maybe we've collated them somewhat different than those which have been before you for about 10 years now. And the judge will be looking at the same kinds of things. The costs of what is being done right now at $120,000 to $130,000 per person, costing $72 million a year on its way toward $100,000. This is a system that can be improved. It needs to be improved, and that's what we're here for. I will tell you finally, of course, in much the same way as Eric did, there's nothing for us in this. We didn't volunteer for this job either. It's a hard, thankless, difficult problem, but it's one that calls for the best kind of public decision-making to make Minnesota as good as it can be.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much to both my testifiers. And so, members, I know that this committee is interested in the details, and so I'd like to walk through where we are. And just to let you know that we do consider this still a work in progress. But let me just give you where we are, and then I know we're not voting on it today, and I hope that you will all feel free to speak with me if you have particular concerns about the bill. And what I'm looking for here is to have a partnership with all of you in making these reforms, because I think unless we feel that we all are partners in doing this, we won't be able to do it. So,
excuse me, Representative Liebling. Representative Paymar has a question, and I think we should.
No, I'll wait until she gets done with the bill.
All right, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So, starting out, Article 1 is about sexual violence prevention, and the reason for this is simple. I view this bill as taking on the broader problem of sexual violence across Minnesota. And so it's important to me that we have a component of this as we look at the very, very expensive MSOP program we have now, that we look at doing better with our money to prevent sexual violence, or at least to figure out how to prevent sexual violence across the state. So that's what this first, these provisions come from MNCASA, which is the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and starting with a state level work group that would cross the various agencies.
Representative Liebling, the A4 amendment actually had on line 1.12, yeah, page 1, delete Article 1, so it is not your intention to have Article 1 deleted?
Yeah, thank you, Liebling. Madam Chair, for reminding me about that. That is a drafting error, so that was not my intention, even though obviously it probably gives us a new committee stop. So that may be a problem later on, but I'm hoping to keep that in there because I think it's very important.
Representative Paymar.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, first let me just say I really just want to thank you for all the work you're doing on this. This is not only takes courage, but it's the right thing to do, and you're handling it very well, and I'm just very appreciative of it, and I agree with our two judges here of the urgency of the matter, and I hope we can act on it this legislative session. But I since this came from MNCASA, I guess I'm a little surprised that the working group that you're creating wouldn't have some representatives of crime victim programs in it. But if it came from MNCASA, I suspect that there's a reason for that. And then I'm a little surprised by some of the permissive language about the may consult and then the shall commit the report and may propose recommendations. But if this is a work in progress, I guess I'll work with you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. I would appreciate that, Representative Paymar. And I know we've all had a lot on our plates this session so far, and I have to say I haven't had as much time to work on that section of the bill. So I would very much appreciate your help on that section.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Article 2, we are creating a new, this is what Justice Magnuson talked about with the lesser restrictive alternatives. And at this point, I do want to point out that the Commissioner of Human Services, Cindy Jessen, is here, and she's here behind me wearing pink for those of you who don't know her, and she's here to answer questions. The reason she's here is because this program is under the auspices of the Department of Human Services. This is not a corrections program. So just want to make that important point. So one of the issues, as you heard, is that there is, right now, we have basically a person gets committed under our sex offender commitment statutes, and they either go behind the razor wire or the judge has to make a very difficult decision to either commit them to what may be a life behind razor wire or to not commit them at all. And so what we're doing here is setting up a system that, I'm sorry, I think I'm misreading my sheet here and I'm skipping ahead. So let me go right to that. I'm looking at the section that's really about the public education about that, and let me just go right to that. So the first thing that really concerns the commissioner is setting up some alternatives that are available to courts and to the system itself to satisfy the federal court that we have something available for people besides just the highest security locked facilities that we have now at Moose Lake and St. Peter. And so right now, as I said, when a person is going through this commitment process, the judge has to make a yes or no decision. And there may very well be cases where a judge who feels that somebody probably ought to be committed and needs treatment is saying no because they have nowhere to send them besides this very highly secure facility, which until now has been basically a life sentence. And judges are very sensitive to that, and I think it puts them often in a very difficult situation. So the first thing we do is set up a system where there's basically a two-step process for commitment. The first decision a judge makes is, does the person meet the commitment criteria? If the judge decides that the person, in fact, does, there would be a time period for the person to be evaluated, a recommendation made as to where they should be placed and what kinds of conditions they should be under, and they would come back for a second hearing at which the judge would make their initial placement decision. And so we have to set up a system of an alternative where it would be possible to place someone, and that's what we're calling strict and intensive supervision and treatment. So this would be a system that would be available to a judge to make a decision initially when the person is placed. It would also be the same basic kinds of facilities that would be available for a person to make progress coming out of the most secure facilities. But initially, one thing that we must do is make sure that we have facilities available, and that's where the Commissioner of Human Services is already working to try to figure out what that might look like. And I know members will probably have questions, more detailed questions about what kinds of conditions and so on. I don't know the answer to those questions yet, but I do know that the process that we're trying to set up would allow for all kinds of input. The prosecutor who was doing the commitment initially would be involved in arguing what those conditions should be and what that placement should be. And there would be an expert evaluation before that placement decision is made. So this would give the court a lot of information and options that currently they simply don't have. Now, this may, in fact, result in more people being committed who are not now committed because of that dynamic that I explained. I don't know that. And if that is, in fact, the case, then I would argue to you that we are, in fact, serving public safety by committing some people who otherwise would be out on the street.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, in this section, then, are we just talking about intensive supervision within the facility, not upon discharge? I'm not clear on that point.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. We have sort of a twofold problem. We have the problem when someone's initially committed that there's this yes or no decision about the secure facility. We also have the problem that Chief Justice Magnuson talked about, that there's nothing in between for a person to progress through treatment, to be moving out. And that's a problem that potentially troubles the federal court a lot. So these facilities that we would develop would be available in both ends. There's a little different process in the bill for going in or coming out, if you will, but it's the same set of facilities, basically. So that's kind of what's contemplated, that first we have to have options where people could be placed. So that's what the development of this strict and intensive supervision looks like. I hope that answers the question.
Kind of.
Representative Johnson.
Just briefly follow up, and who would provide, who are you thinking might be doing the supervising?
Representative
Liebling. The intensive supervision.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Johnson, these are folks who are under the supervision of the Commissioner of Human Services. So these are people that are in her custody now, mm-hmm. basically, and it's contemplated that those would be the same people. Now, sometimes people might also be on intensive can't think of the term right now, when they're on intensive supervision after release from prison, in which case they'd be, I think there'd be a system of dual supervision because they'd be both under the Department of Corrections and under the Department of Human Services, and there would have to be some arrangements worked out, and that isn't worked out yet in the bill.
Representative Liebling, I have consistently had difficulty in the correction sides with private prisons, for example. Are you envisioning that any of these supervisions would be done by private entities, or would they all be state entities? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a question I think would probably be better answered by the commissioner, if you would want to have her come up, because...
And if there's a better time, if you want to keep walking through the bill, I'm fine with that, but that is one of the concerns I've had in the other area.
Thank you, and I'm sure she's noting that question, and well, maybe we could wait, and we'll finish walking through, and then we'll get her up. So,
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. So I want to emphasize that we are not changing the standard for committing someone. We are not tinkering with that at all. So in terms of committing people, the only thing we're changing is we're making it a two-step process because of this problem that we've described about the yes or no decision. So another thing that's being changed in the bill that I think is very important is who is doing this examining that we are talking about. Initially, right now, under the bill, after a person is determined to meet the criteria, they're committed to the Department of Human Services, to the MSOP program. Then MSOP comes and does an evaluation and makes recommendations so that the court and the prosecutor can weigh in and the person's attorney can weigh in, and there's a full discussion and hearing on the issue of what their proper placement and conditions would be. We also have to talk about people who are already in the MSOP program and the system right now by which they petition to leave that program. And this is something that is also being changed in the bill, because one of the big considerations, as you heard, is that nobody ever seems to make progress. So what we're doing here is changing that system. We're taking there right now. There's a special review board that, when a person petitions to be for a reduction in custody, the special review board reviews that, and then there's a special court panel, which is called the Supreme Court Appeals Panel. It's not really an appellate court. It's a special court. We call it the SCAP, and it's set up to review these. We are proposing to change that a little bit to give the SCAP more authority and to get rid of that initial review panel. The point here is to take the politics out of these decisions. We want to have these decisions made by experts along with the court, with input from the prosecutors and, of course, the person's attorney. So we're proposing a system here where every 2 years a person's a report would be done, and a special panel of evaluators, or one of them, would evaluate the person, look at all the records of their treatment over the 2 years, and write a report that would go to the court. This is without any involvement by the person themselves. It would go to the court. The court would look at those to determine whether a prima facie case has been made, or whether there's a prima facie case for a hearing on a possible change of custody status. Now, the reason we are proposing this, if you lately there was another report from the legislative auditor about the state-operated services program, which is different but kind of related, under the Department of Human Services, where the auditor pointed to the fact that there were people in that program who never seemed to get reviewed. What we need to do here is make sure that every person who's in confinement has at least a paper review and in some kind of an evaluation by an independent evaluator, in order to make sure that what the people are doing in the program, that there is real treatment going on. So this has a couple of good benefits. One, it will decrease the sort of paperwork churning that we're seeing right now, where people can petition every 6 months. And there's kind of a, you know, if you're in that situation, you're going to probably petition every 6 months a lot of the time, whether you have had any change in your situation or not. What this does is take an independent panel of evaluators who kind of take a second look at the person and also look at the work that's being done with them inside the program. And what we hope this would do is raise the level of the treatment, because as a treatment provider, if you know that the people you're working with, your work is going to be looked at independently every couple of years, you're going to raise your game. And so that's one way that we hope, without micromanaging what the treatment providers are doing, we hope to raise their profile a little bit and make sure that they are actually attempting to make people move through treatment. So that brings us to another piece, which is this group of independent evaluators. Our thinking about this is to have these evaluators to create a separate unit that would be under the auspices of the court, to take those people out of DHS so that there isn't any you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, but a truly independent panel that the court would appoint an examiner to be looking at the person. So every 2 years, you get this review, you get this an opportunity, the person can get the report from the examiner, have an opportunity to respond, the prosecutor can respond to that, it all goes to the court looks at it, and the court may say, nah, nothing changed, no hearing, we're done with that person. On the other hand, if the court says, something's changed, it's worth looking into further, then a hearing is established, and then everybody comes in and presents their case about if something should change, and if so what, and what the new conditions should be, and so on. And so through that system, although it initially this is probably not a money saver, it is a system that would mean that nobody would just languish there without anyone looking at them ever again. And those people who in the program who are capable of making some progress, I think it would create a system where they would be more likely to be making progress, because right now there's an element of, since people never get out, a lot of people who might actually want to work toward treatment are sort of discouraged from doing that.
Representative Liebling, previously the court had the guardian ad litem board under the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, and they actually had that spun off because they felt that it was a conflict for the guardian ad litem board to be under the court's jurisdiction when they were either taking the recommendations or not taking the recommendations. So how would you envision that this panel would be different and not present that conflict that the court identified with that program? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's not one I've really thought about. I have to say, though, as we've struggled with this, how to do this, and a lot of people have been working with me on this, including staff from DHS and Mr. Kerwin, from prosecutor from Hennepin County, and a lot of us have been thinking about this. There's no perfect way to do this. And if somebody has a better way, I would love to work with you on that. Right now, though, we're thinking that because there has been this sort of, right now the way it's been is that DHS is making the recommendation and DHS is involved in the decision, and that there's too little independent oversight over that whole process. You would have a situation, what's contemplated is a situation where, and this isn't all fleshed out yet, but if the person thought, the patient would have a chance to sort of to say if they didn't want a certain examiner. So there's a pool of professional examiners, and our hope is that because they work on this all the time, that they would become very, very good at, you know, seeing through the baloney and understanding when somebody, you know, get a better, more evidence-based view of how dangerous people are and whether they're really making progress. And that because they're under the auspices of the court, because a person can have be able to say, no, I don't want that examiner, and because the prosecutors would also be involved in coming in and saying we agree, we don't agree with what's been said here, that there are some protections around that. I'm not sure if I totally answered your question.
I think former Judge Magnuson, how do you want me to address you? Judge Magnuson, Mr. Magnuson, how would you like to be addressed?
Anything but late for dinner, I guess. Okay. Is what they say. I think Justice Magnuson is fine, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was involved in the guardian ad litem transfer, and the concern was that the guardians ad litem were in many cases actually employees of the court. As I understand this proposal, the examiners might be administered by the court, but they will be funded by DHS. They will not be employees of the court. So in that instance, they are like any other expert witness that the court may appoint. And I don't think that there's the concern that existed with the guardians ad litem.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that, I would just add the court itself in this case, although it is a court, is actually, as I understand, funded by DHS, too. So that is the system that we have now, I believe. At least there's some kind of a transfer of funding to cover this.
Excuse me, Representative Johnson.
I thank you, Madam Chair. One of the issues that I need some clarification on is not only the process of being discharged, but once the person is discharged, if the person is not on supervised release or conditional release through corrections, is the person then discharged with no supervision whatsoever because they've completed their sentence? Is that how that works, or is there some kind of ongoing supervision?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, I'm not sure if you are talking about now or under the bill. I assume you mean under the bill.
Under the bill.
Right? The bill actually does not deal with discharge as such. This bill is not changing either the standard for discharge or the ultimate discharge conditions. So I'm not sure I even really know the answer to that question about what happens now, because we haven't seen it happen yet. And so maybe Chief Justice Magnuson knows the answer to that.
Justice Magnuson.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the representative is correct. There is no change as a result of this legislation as to either the procedures or consequences of a release from the confinement, the secure confinement. It's my understanding that you would continue, depending upon the therapeutic state of whoever is being released, there certainly would be some follow-up. This doesn't change the law. Now, one of the things our task force is charged by the federal court to look at is exactly that. It's the input side and the output side, and we haven't really focused on those yet, because our first charge by December was to do the middle part. And you know, broadly speaking, what this bill does is it changes a little bit the procedure but not the substance for people getting into the system. It provides for maybe a more rational decision-making process, committable or not committable, and then a decision as to what level of security the committee warrants. What's the best therapeutic environment? What's the safest for the public? Right now, the presumptive commit is everybody goes to Moose Lake. And, you know, if you're lucky, you get to go to St. Peter after that, but nobody gets out. So the changes here are really kind of incremental and moving people to this middle part where you can have an appropriate confinement model coupled with the therapeutic model, so people can actually receive appropriate treatment and hopefully make progress. And then there are some provisions in here about how you review how they're moving through. That's been a big problem if you see the legislative auditor's report. This doesn't change the standards, either the standards for commitment or the standards for release. It is an attempt to rationalize what you do with these folks when they're there, and that is the first step, and it's an important step.
That was very helpful. Thank you.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you. So you skipped over Article 3, Representative Liebling, but Justice Magnuson is sort of repeat my question here. I had the question earlier, so because we are talking about the middle ground, if I understand it, or the middle process where we have a less restrictive place, residence, for instance, rather than MSOP is sort of, that would be more cost effective, but still ensure public safety. I'm just, when I see Article 3, and I, maybe this is a question that's premature, I'm envisioning that we're going to have interim housing in various parts of the state, depending on where the crime was committed. And so my maybe, again, premature because there's no fiscal note, I'm just wondering, had you thought about what the cost to the counties might be? It looks to me in Article 3 that the counties will pick up the lion's share of providing that that treatment, unless that's going to be, unless the commissioner can tell me that DHS is going to pay for that. It looks like the county's going to have to pay for that. And having gone to the last community notification meeting, I think it was Golden Valley was the last sex offender that from, and was that the last MSOP offender that was, or level commissioner that, was that in Golden Valley? I was there, and I mean, I don't know what that person will ever do without, you know, talk about intensive supervision. That person can't even blow their nose without having somebody there, which is fine, you know, and people in Golden Valley were obviously concerned about it, but how's the counties going to pay for all this middle ground that you talk about, Justice Magnuson? Or is this premature? Is that all premature of how we're going to do that?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Paymar, the attempt in our latest amendment is to try to keep the county's share as close to what it is now as possible. And so right now they pay 25% of the freight for people who are in MSOP. And so we're kind of keeping that. That's certainly open for discussion. We don't know what the fiscal note is going to be. And in the bill, too, a lot of the effective dates are out so that we will have time to get some of these things running and going. And certainly, as you know, things can change and get worked through as the process moves along. Our real urgency, I think, is to get something in motion, because it does take a long time to change a system like this and to get these sorts of facilities set up and make some of these decisions. And the county cost is, believe me, it's something that there's been some input on. There'll be a lot more, I'm sure, before we get anything enacted here. So I think it's great to flag that concern, but this is a very expensive deal. And in the Health and Human Services budget right now, I think the bill is carrying something like, I forget, it's like $7 or $9 million just for increases, expected increases over the biennium if we do nothing. And this is just growing and growing and growing. So somehow we've got to figure out where to get money for this in one way or another.
Madam Chairman.
Justice Magnuson.
Madam Chairman, Representative Paymar, it's hard to spend more money than the state is right now per committed individual. They're all in the most secure confinement. It's $120,000 a year. One of the things that the commissioner has done at the suggestion of our task force is started to survey the state to see what kinds of facilities and programs are available. Maybe state run, maybe privately contracted. It would depend on all of the circumstances. But if, as Representative Liebling said, if you don't do anything, there are going to be 50 to 60 more people in the system in the next year. That's the average input into the system. That's $120,000 a year. That's $7, $8 million more expense every year if you don't change anything.
Madam Chair, to that point,
Representative Paymar,
I totally get that. I mean, I know how much this costs. But I also am sensitive as a representative of a county that's probably going to pay for a lot of those offenders. As who's the head of the county here? Anybody? Well, I would imagine Hennepin and Ramsey County are going to pay the bulk of it if the state doesn't. But again, it might be premature if the state doesn't have some way of reimbursing counties for what's going to be a very expensive startup, maybe not equivalent to housing someone at MSOP, but this is not going to be cheap because people are going to be concerned and watching, and we have to get this right. And to get it right, it's going to cost money. Would you not agree?
Absolutely.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this would be an appropriate time to have the commissioner come up because she's probably more able to speak to some of that than these gentlemen are.
Why don't we just get her a chair and we can pull her up and then she can stay to answer any questions that we might have.
Sure, that means we're not off the hook, right?
You're not. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, would you like me to answer first your question, I think, about public versus private or Representative Paymars?
Just go ahead.
After we received the initial recommendations from the task force, which we received in December, at the end of December, the department issued a request for information. And we sent this to providers, actually not just providers in our state, both public providers through our state-operated services system as well as private providers, but actually providers across the country. We've sent requests for information, and we asked them very broadly about what they would be willing to, what kind of services they would be willing to provide to people who either at the front end or at the back end of this program, so people kind of who might be served in a secure setting, but not as secure as MSOP, or who might be provisionally discharged to a setting, kind of so that we could look at what's available on this continuum if we were going to build a continuum of services. And we asked them to tell us what kind of security they would have, what kind of mental health treatment, sex offender treatment they had, what kind of experience they had providing that treatment. We asked for costs. We asked for where they would be willing to do that in Minnesota as well as their experience with this, and what types of populations they would be willing to serve. I must say we received responses from 21 different providers. That included both our state-operated providers, so public providers, as well as private providers. And what we found is that we had providers willing to serve this population in secured settings. And some of them would have done the treatment themselves. Some of them contracted out across our state, and that includes our state-operated services providers. We asked for information on costs, and obviously that depends a lot on the type of treatment that's needed as well as the amount of security that is needed. But I think we really were able to get a great deal of information about that so that we have a better sense today about what this might look like should the legislature direct us to develop these programs. Our thought was that we would be just even in the next couple of weeks issuing an RFP so we can get more concrete information available for provision of these services.
I just want to ask a question on that. So I have had concerns over the years about, for example, private prisons. Is there anyone else in the country who uses private services for this? Because when you're taking away someone's freedoms, I feel very strongly that the state has a responsibility to that person. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, yes, in other states there are contracts with private providers for some of these services. I would say, Madam Chair, if I may, if we looked at the example of the individual who was provisionally discharged from the program last year, kind of as one example of how this has worked. Now that's a provisional discharge, but I think that was part of the questions here. You know, in that situation, the department had put out a request for proposals and had contracts with a couple of different providers. You know, that individual was originally placed at the court's direction in a halfway house, and now is at the court's direction, you know, in a secured apartment setting. So in that situation, there's some of the mental health services and security. It's really a combination. We have security provided for that individual, both through the provider, but as well as MSOP. So kind of depending on the needs, we had certainly during the first several months and now continue to have state employees also going out, meeting with that individual, checking on, you know, what is happening with that individual. So we would see this going forward as it's not just handing someone, even if we were going to use private providers, we would see that there would be this strong role for MSOP staff to be providing a lot, checking on and providing a lot of that security particularly.
Then to represent Paymar's question. Do we remember what it was, represent Paymar?
Oh.
Yeah, do you want me to ask it again?
That would be great, Representative Paymar.
I just had you thought through the impact on counties, since I would assume Ramsey and Hennepin County would have the bulk of, at some point, the bulk of patients in our counties that will need this kind of supervised, intensive supervision and residence. Residences and what and right now under current law I'm just trying to get at what the cost will be and whether you're envisioning the state would reimburse counties at a higher level.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, the way I read the Representative Liebling's bill was that this would really just continue as she suggested the current arrangement. In 2011, the law was changed. Before counties paid for 10% of the cost of a client being served at MSOP, it was raised to 25% in 2011. This bill would continue that. I didn't envision this as being having the counties pay for startup costs. I think actually, if you do this correctly, kind of through contracts, I think we could. There are ways to minimize where you're not having bonding bills that are building new buildings. Around this, and I think so from my perspective, the way I read the bill was this is really just a continuation of the current arrangement with counties, and one that if we did it right, counties would be less expensive overall, as Justice Magnuson suggested.
Representative Paymar, follow up. All right, Representative Liebling.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. I think, I have the sense I maybe didn't present this in the most orderly fashion, but I hope that you all kind of have the sense of where we're trying to go here. And I really do invite your questions and your input. And really, again, I want to say that if we're going to be able to do anything as a legislature, this is an area, another one of those areas where we must do it bipartisanly. And so I'm really looking to all of you for leadership, especially those of you on this committee, this is still a work in progress. We're really trying to get all the input we can. We're trying to meet as many concerns as we're able to, because at the end of the day, this really has to be something that a great majority of us can support. And if we can't do that, this is for me kind of a, an all or nothing. I think you saw in the article, and maybe you heard a little more about this. If this becomes a political football, if this is going to not be a bipartisan issue, we're not going to be able to do anything. But the details of it, I really want to work with people on, and I know that the commissioner does as well, and everyone who's involved in this, who's been deeply involved in it, really wants to get it right, and that means meeting as many concerns as we possibly can, because ultimately we have to meet the concerns of Minnesotans. And ultimately we know that, this kind of public safety is such an important issue, and especially when we're talking about sex offenses and sex offenders, we know that this is something around which people have a lot of concern, and rightly so. But I think that we need to get Minnesotans to understand that we need to make a change. And also, back to my point that I don't believe we're using our limited public dollars in the most effective way. Sometimes we talk about how we're locking up the worst of the worst, and if you even take that little kind of trite phrase, the worst of the worst, then what's happening to the worst who aren't the worst of the worst? We're doing probably not much. So while we're focusing on this really small number of people, we're not focusing on a lot of other issues that we probably ought to be, because our dollars are more and more and more going to be only in this very small pool of people. So I think we can do better. And to do better, we're going to have to do better together. And so I really thank you for your attention. And I really hope to work with everybody on this committee and everybody. And this is Senate. There's a Senate bill, and it's moving through quite you know, and it is moving in the Senate as well. So
we have questions.
I hope we're going to deal with this.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if who wants to take a stab at this question, but the working group, you know, I understand maybe why you've put it in place, but aren't there other working groups that have happened in other states? What has worked in other states? What are the best practices? I just think, are we spinning our wheels with another working group? And are we going to have any different outcomes in our working group than what any other state did? And what is the cost of, I don't know if there's a cost to the working group. I see there's some money appropriated for, looks like almost $1 million for sexual violence prevention demonstration partnership grants. And so if one of you want to take a stab at why we're doing the working group instead of looking other places first.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think, Representative Scott, thank you for the question. I think you're talking about the task force that's in here in Article 1, probably. Yeah, I just want to make that clear because we've got this other task force that the court set up that the two judges are part of.
I got excited and, about the million. I apologize.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so this came from, this language came from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And so I just kind of took their language from another bill. And I'm certainly not an expert on that. And so the thought was that not that, and there are, you know, I'm sure a lot of work's been done. This was an attempt to get cross-agency work done, to get the various agencies of Minnesota government to come together to say, we've done this successfully in some other things lately, too, especially like there was just a big effort around substance abuse that crossed all the agencies. So, you know, what does corrections have to say, and what does human services have to say, and what does the health department have to say, and what does education have to say, and how can we break some of those silos? So that's the intention, but, you know, I'm willing to continue working. The same thing, I'm not wedded to any piece of this. I want this to be a collective product. So the idea with the grants, same thing. It was felt that some money should be put into doing some actual work on this issue. But it's certainly all open to change and discussion.
So Representative Liebling, because this is the judiciary, of course, I do have a number of questions about the court's role. And you had alluded to the fact that you thought that the Health and Human Services Department actually paid for the review panel that's done through the court. So if we could actually just get walked through what role the court plays kind of at each step, if someone could walk this committee through that, that would probably be helpful. Representative Liebling, who's best for that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think maybe Mr. Vu Benson from the Department of Human Services would be the best person to do that, unless the commissioner wants to. Oh, maybe if the commissioner feels comfortable, she is certainly.
Commissioner Jessen, go ahead.
Madam Chair, and I'm sure my colleague Robin Vivinson will jump in if he thinks I've said this done this wrong, but just for an overview, it is, of course, the courts that ultimately that first make that commitment decision. And as Representative Liebling said, that her bill does not change that criteria. It instead just has the court first decide if someone should be committed, and then if they are, make a separate decision after getting kind of a recommendation evaluation from the department with input on should that commitment be to Moose Lake or to one of these CIST, the strict and intensive supervision and treatment facilities. So there's that original committing court. And if I may, kind of as I go along, say I think one of the things this bill provides is then kind of some additional oversight by the courts. So when we look at other states, one of the best practices from other states is you usually have the committing court do annual or biannual evaluations. Should this person continue to be committed? And that's one of the things we don't have here in our civil commitment statute in Minnesota. But after that commitment is made and the individual now goes to Moose Lake, then as it works now, if the person, and they can every 6 months, as Representative Liebling said, ask for either a different place in our system or to be provisionally discharged, they actually petition a special review board. A special review board then can make, which is established by the department. So that's kind of a more interdepartment. It's an individual expert, has to be an attorney, psychiatrist, and a mental health expert. And then they will make a recommendation from the special review board. And then that recommendation can be appealed, basically. And as commissioner, often I am called upon by statute to weigh in, do I agree or not with that recommendation. And that recommendation can then go from one side or the other to the special review board, which is a review board of, not a special review board, but the Supreme Court Appeals Panel, which is called the SCAP. And that is, those are judges appointed by the Supreme Court. And they can then hear those, you know, kind of really in some ways appeals from the special review board. And make a decision. Should the person be provisionally discharged? Should the person be able to advance from, for an example, from phase two of treatment to phase to our community preparation services? Those are some of the decisions that are made first by our special, our SRB, Special Review Board, and then the Supreme Court Appeals Panel. You know, now, what I know about the payment is I know that we worked with the Supreme Court Administrator's Office because we weren't getting enough hearing dates, and we thought that there was too much of a backlog. So we contracted with the Supreme Court Administration to pay for more the salaries of some of the fill-in judges so that we could have more judges on these panels so we would pay for their replacements on the trial court. So there, now I don't, you know, and I'll have to ask our folks if you want a lot more detail around that, but I do remember really meeting and negotiating the deal where we would be paying to kind of backfill for those judges so that they could sit on the staff.
So every 6 months, does that review actually make it to the court, or which ones are weeded out that don't actually make it to the Supreme Court review panel? Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, every 6 months the individual has the right to petition in first the SRB, and then if the SRB says no, they can appeal that to the SCAP. It's a lengthy process. So it's not even, by the time then they get the SCAP ruling, and if the SCAP says no, you can't be provisionally discharged, then as I understand it, the 6 months would start running again, and then they could start the whole process again.
So, Commissioner, in fact, do the majority of folks then do this every 6 months and go through this court process? So is the court really seeing kind of on a rotating basis about 600 or so cases every 6 months, kind of on a rotating basis? Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, I do not know the exact number, but I would say the majority of people do on a regular basis petition first the special review board and then take that to the SCAP. I think that I just actually interviewed all of the new applicants for the special review board, and they would including the current ones, and they would say the vast majority of the petitions that they see at that level are for people who are kind of routinely doing this, and that's may I say, Madam Chair, on our sex offender population. Our special review board also makes recommendations for our clients who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous. And that's really a separate matter. More of those have actually treatment team support. So I think one of the things that Representative Liebling's bill does, by having kind of these regular assessments, and then the assessments would go to the special review board, and then the special review board would have time to say, okay, looking at this assessment, should we hold a hearing?
No court.
The court that would say, should there be a hearing? So instead of just having this lengthy process, there would be regular assessments. The special review board would be eliminated. But there would be the Supreme Court Appeals Panel judges who would be, at least every other year, looking at an independent assessment and determining if a hearing would be appropriate.
Representative Liebling, so do you believe that then that would create additional cases in the judiciary or fewer cases in the judiciary? Based on what the practice is now versus what you think this practice would be in the future. Representative Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, it's certainly, I think at least initially, it would create more, possibly. Maybe Mr. Vu Benson could give us the numbers of how many people right now actually do this petition process every 6 months. I mean, well, obviously we're going from 6 months to 2 years, so you have a reduction there, a significant reduction. But you're making sure, see, right now there's this potential issue that well, let me back up even more. There are people in our MSOP program who are low functioning and things like that. And so those people would be reviewed just like everybody else. That right now, it may be true that most people do petition, but you're really relying on the person themselves to come forward and petition. What we're trying to do here is sort of weed out the ones who have made real advancement from those who just want to keep, you know, I mean, if anyone who's in there, of course, is naturally going to want to try to get out all the time, but we want to sort of try to separate the wheat from the chaff by having this, having a real assessment by an independent examiner every 2 years, and having the court then look at those results. So it's just a very different process. It doesn't rely on the person themselves to come forward. It doesn't deny them the opportunity to add what they'd like to add, but it does reduce the frequency. So I would say it's an attempt to make it more meaningful, but less often.
Justice Magnuson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The current process is this. When someone is about to be released from their prison term, the Department of Corrections mainly makes a recommendation to the county attorney that they consider a petition. County attorney decides whether to petition. The petition's granted. They're committed. Once they're committed, and they're committed by a district court judge. Once they're committed, every 6 months, they can make a petition to be moved, to be provisionally discharged, or discharged. There's a whole process by which those are evaluated. There's a special review board that is not a court. It's a lawyer. It is a psychiatrist and a mental health professional. They make a recommendation. If the committed person doesn't like that, they can appeal it to the Supreme Court panel. The Supreme Court panel has to consider it, rule on the merits. Under the new proposal, once the decision to commit has been made, then every 24 months, whether the committed person or not wants the review, a review will be done, and their progress and the appropriateness of their placement will be made. Committed person can participate, but it goes to a judicial appeal panel that isn't required to have a hearing. They can look at it and say, there's no reason to have a hearing. There has been such little change. So in the end, it not only streamlines the process, but it addresses one of the very real concerns in the federal court litigation, and that is you have these people who are committed, some who really, you know, can't take care of themselves, and the burden's on them to show that they deserve to be moved someplace else. And there's no, you know, other than they have to file a petition, there's no annual review. This sets up a structure by which people are reviewed and the decision is made whether they should progress through the system. And to have that process in place, now you have a pipeline. Now you have a path for people to follow. And it will, I think, address some of the serious constitutional issues.
Judge Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, this is somewhat, in my mind, an analog. In the federal system, if you committed somebody for being mentally ill, incompetent, and unable to defend themselves, by statute, you are required to review that decision every single year. Right now, you have a number of people who are in, who I think it is fair to say do not have a sense that they are getting a real review of their status. This would be a regularized, systematic review, so that the system doesn't just forget somebody while they're there either. You have to sort of feel that maybe people think that way because nobody's getting out. You can take all the courses, you can pass everything, and nobody moves. And they wonder whether or not they're moving at all. And this, I think, sets out a formal system for the committing authority as well as for the person who's committed, that they know that they will have to be reviewed.
Madam Chair, if I might, we have four district court judges on our task force, two of whom sit on the Supreme Court appellate panel, we have discussed these changes, and they think it's a more workable system, for whatever that's worth. The people that are actually doing the work think this is better.
Questions from members? Representative Cornish.
You want to hear my plan?
Representative Cornish.
Just some comments. I think, first of all, the judge might have copped out a little bit in this, and if he wanted a decision, why he just took a path to follow just one of these things, because he's going to run the same problem we have. You just settle this one portion for 2 years, and where we go round and around the wheel again. I wish you would have just made a decision, or at least, when we talked yesterday, you talked about one piece of the puzzle. Some of our members felt uncomfortable with just looking at one piece. We wanted to look at the whole spectrum. There's some of your plan, Representative Liebling, as you know, I agree with. But real quickly, taking it completely out of the political hands, having no sitting judges, but have retired judges and non-political people, so they wouldn't depend on getting their job back if, you know, I'm saying, or getting out of their job if they made what some people consider the wrong decision. And if the county, we got to quit trying to please everybody. When I had my bill up, the counties complained about this, the public defenders complained about that, corrections complained about something. They all said they would like to work on it. It was interesting, and they want to keep working, but then it got stalled out. And I think we'll never make anybody happy. We're just going to have to make some hard decisions. And one of the ideas that I had was turn it over to more criminal, start sorting these people out, because we're letting a level three people out of prison that are more dangerous than the people that are in the SOP program. And so having it to admit that, I think we've got to send less people to the SOP program. So my plan was to make a special category of sexual predatory offender, the serious, and take that away from the person that falls in love with somebody underage, a statutory rape on the other end of the scale. So start to weed the real serious ones out, give them a 60-year sentence, and make them serve two-thirds of it before they're even eligible for the program. And that's what corrections thought, is it would give them more time to look at these people and know what they're really dealing with over the long period of time. And then after they get out into this thing, it's a one strike. I mean, if you screw up on intensive supervised release, you're back in for the full 60, and you're 78 years old when you get out, and more than likely can't harm anybody anymore. So just in general, but then I have to admit, after we get all that done, I still don't know if you get the number of votes for it, because the person that makes the decision to pass this legislation is going to think about that one person that messes up and reoffends, and they'll feel some of the guilt for it. So I agree, it's a really touchy subject, but I think taking the politics out of it, turning more of a criminal, because there's really not much of an argument if you increase a sentence, the constitutional problem of putting somebody in either without a conviction or somebody with no treatment, because we don't really have a huge obligation to treat them if we just sentence them. And so anyway, those are my thoughts on it, and separating them out, sending less people to the SOP program to begin with is going to help with the cost. And then some of those in Texas claimed they made it work when they appeared at the William Mitchell College. You know, of course they do it a little bit differently, but they said they had almost no recidivism rate and they had an intensive supervised release. And I don't know what that means, if not only the leg bracelet when you take it off takes that leg off, or if you know, something more serious than just GPS monitoring. So.
Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Cornish. You know, those are good points, and, you know, thank you for your work on this. And I think, as you so well understand, we can only, this is about the chunk we're trying to deal with here is the people that are already done with their sentences, and we can't go back and resentence them again. I think what Texas does is when they're on that release, if a violation becomes a crime, and then then they're convicted of the crime of the violation, and that's, you know, actually that idea has some appeal. But in the first instance, you'd have to have this, what I think they have kind of a community supervision model where people have, you know, are essentially, you know, all in the community. They don't have a locked facility, as I understand it, certainly nothing like what we have. But anyway, to the point about wanting to do more, I think you're absolutely right. It's really hard to get, this is a hard thing to do. And so what I'm explicitly doing is not trying to solve the entire problem. And I think you and I could probably agree on a lot of the other elements of this that need to be dealt with. But there is a piece in front of us that we really have to do something about, and that is because of the court, and because, you know, we have to do something about making sure that there's some kind of a sense that people have a pathway that they can move along. And so what I'm proposing is really aimed at that. In no way am I thinking I'm solving the entire issue, but I'm hoping that if we can start, as a legislature, start to learn to move these muscles, then in a future year we can come back and you know, continue to work on the problem. But we got to start somewhere. And I think, you know, that might be what maybe the buzzsaw that you ran into was that when you really try to fix the problem, somebody's going to be unhappy. And that's the way legislation works anyway. We all know that. It's very rare to get everybody satisfied with everything. So I think if we can just pick out the pieces that we can really do something about and really put our minds to doing something, I hope we can get something done this year.
Representative Liebling, we really only have 3 minutes left of committee, and we haven't even asked for any public testimony yet. So I think this is going to need a lot of discussion, and I'm certain there are questions. So rather than opening it up for additional public testimony, do you have anyone else on your panel that you'd like to have us hear from? Because I think there are a number of pieces that people may have questions about as well.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't. I think we'd be glad to take more questions. We really appreciate the time and appreciate that this is a very complicated issue, and we all want to get it right. So thank you.
So are there any other questions from members at this point? Representative Drazkowski, then Representative Cornish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to be clear, back to Representative Johnson's question. It sounds like, you know, we don't have anything in law in terms of what happens when they're discharged, and that's been really been done ad hoc by the courts to this point. Is that accurate? Did I hear things properly?
Who would like that question? Well, Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, well, Representative Drazkowski, I'm not sure if you mean discharge, you mean like provisional discharge from the MSOP program or total discharge? Because we do know what provisional discharge looks like for the one person who's gotten one, but that's really all we know. In terms of total discharge, I don't even know how to answer that question. I don't know if the commissioner does.
Say, Madam Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you. Representative Liebling does say provisional discharge in the bill. That's what I was referring to. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Representative Drazkowski, Madam Chair. And maybe I'll let the commissioner answer that one. I mean, if in the bill, what it looks like is we're not talking anymore about provisional discharge in this bill. We're talking about being still under the auspices of MSOP, but MSOP having some different looking facilities that it can put people in to move them through. But the whole, you know, getting a discharge from that is still a court process with the same standards it has today. And if we want to look at what happens when somebody is actually discharged, that's not in my bill. But I, you know, that maybe that's a task you would want to take on. Is how what happens after that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this time, Representative Liebling, just trying to learn more about the bill, the scope of the bill and what the scope does not include. Thank you.
Final question, Representative Cornish, and then we're out of time.
Commissioner, what do you say, and this isn't my accusation, but what do you think about the question that gets asked that you can already do this if you wanted to at the state level or commissioner level, could release people? What can you really do and can't do as far as releasing somebody now without legislative approval? And what about the claim that the only reason the state is asking for is trying to take the burden off their back of releasing these? They want the legislative approval. What can you do right now? Can you release people?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, thank you for the question. You know, really, as Representative Liebling said before, this bill doesn't change anything about the provisional discharge, criteria, legal criteria, or the process at all. So I'm certainly not trying to, you know, to do that in this bill. It doesn't even address provisional discharge. You know, the provisional discharge decision is made by the courts, and there's a statute that is enacted by the legislature setting out that criteria. The only role as commissioner I play is that I have to either kind of support or not support or a petition that has been made its way through that special review board to the judicial appeals panel. It's not my decision, and this bill doesn't have anything to do with the whole provisional discharge process. But there are a number of things that were in the legislative auditor's report that, you know, the department could change, and we made a lot of changes. But there's some things that we can't change. you know, we can't tell judges, or it's really, I think, for the legislature to say to judges, when you're making this commitment decision, you have more than one option. Because what we can do at MSOP is once people are committed to us, you know, we make decisions about the treatment. So I don't think I'm trying to use this in any way to deal with the discharge question, because it doesn't even reach it.
All right. Well, with that, thank you, Representative Liebling, and the chair lays over House File 1139. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.